Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Will Schwalbe. He is a journalist and author whose latest book, We Should Not Be Friends, is a testament to the miracle of human connection, if only we see past our differences. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thank you, Hannah. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to have you. And this sounds like a really wonderful story. It's kind of like a real life The Breakfast Club, isn't it?
Yes, that it turned out I hadn't realized that's what I was writing when I was writing it. But that's the effect. It's about a bunch of people thrown together who have nothing in common and the kinds of amazing friendships that can result and focusing on one friendship in particular.
Yeah. So tell us about you and what you were like at university before you met Chris.
So, well, this was in the early 80s, and I was a theater kid. I was an out gay kid, which was sort of unusual in the early 80s at an American university. I was a AIDS activist, and I was convinced that I knew everybody I needed or wanted to know. And senior year, I was placed in a remarkable secret society whose purpose was to bring together the 15 most different kids at university, and one of them was a character named Chris Maxey, this legendary jock, arms so big he had to cut a V in his Lacoste shirts just to get them through. He was a wrestler, he was a rugby player, he was loud, he was obnoxious, and I thought, oh no, this not this kid, I'll just steer a wide berth. And that's where the book begins.
Oh, amazing. And before you met Chris, you'd always kind of had this idea that the kind of jock, you know, person like him, you'd never get on with someone like him. You know, you had nothing in common and you probably didn't view him in the best of light, shall we say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would see these packs of jocks, as we call them, roaming through the dining halls and wolfing down big platters of eggs and being loud and obnoxious. And I just thought I better steer clear of these people. And Maxey, as I called him, was definitely one of them. But one of the things I really wanted to get across in this book is that Maxey was probably a little prejudiced against me. In fact, I know he was, but I was way more prejudiced against him. I made a lot of assumptions about who he was and who he wanted to be based on the fact that he hung out with the jocks, he was a jock, and he was loud.
Yeah. For people who maybe don't understand the expression jock, because I know it's definitely an American term. I mean, I've heard it from plenty of American films and TV shows. But just in case there isn't anyone who kind of understands what it means, how would you describe a jock?
A jock is an athlete who defines themselves entirely by sports. So whether they're a rugby player or a footballer, jocks tend, when we talk about them, tend to be team athletes. So it's not so much a tennis player or a golfer as someone who plays rugby or football, and who they're men who like to be in the company of other physically imposing, loud men.
Yeah. And then normally, I mean, again, I'm getting this from American films and stuff, but is it normally, they're normally like the popular kids and all the girls fancy them as well? Is that right?
Well, true. But actually, that used to be the kind of big man on campus, we would call it. But it's more really that they define themselves in their physicality.
Okay.
That they're brawn. They define themselves as brawn, not brain.
Yeah, interesting. So can you tell us about what happened when you met Chris and were kind of forced to interact with him initially?
So, well, he actually seemed to be perfectly open to getting to know me. And quite quickly on, I realized that maybe I was wrong about him. And as part of this secret society where we had to have dinner together twice a week for an entire year, we had to tell each other our life stories, and we had to go away on a special retreat in the autumn all together. And it was actually on that first retreat that he insisted he drive me back to campus on the back of his huge motorcycle. And I really didn't do that. I really But he made me, and it was an overture of friendship. And that really set the course for the next 40 years with its huge ups and downs. I will add, too, that part of this secret society experience was what we called the audit, where we would tell each other our entire life stories. And that was also an incredibly emotional, important thing for both of us and for everybody in the society, because that's actually where you start to realize that maybe you have got people wrong, that maybe you have been too quick to judge them.
Yeah, this sounds like an amazingly wonderful idea that your university does. Is this a common, normal thing to happen in American universities?
It's totally uncommon. I think it's okay. Unique. Never heard of anything else like it. And that's where you started. That's the Breakfast Club aspect of it, which is they force 15 kids to spend an entire year together. And none of us had ever seen each other before. And of the 15, we're almost all still in close contact. It is an incredible social experiment that works.
That's wonderful. What a great idea. So you're saying you're still friends with most of the group now. How many years on?
40.
Wow. That's really amazing. And so do you get together socially or just keep in touch, like on the phone and on email?
In my New York book launch, 10 of the 15 showed up.
Wow. That's so lovely. That's really wonderful.
So different. And it's, I'm so fascinated to talk to you and your listeners, because a hallmark of our experience is Maxie, my friend who this book is about, entered the Navy SEALs, which is our U.S. equivalent of Special Forces.
Yeah.
So he was stationed abroad for years in Panama and Colombia. I lived in Hong Kong. Another member lives in France now. Other one lived in Poland. San Francisco, we scattered across the world, but we made the effort to keep in touch, and at a time when it was much harder to keep in touch.
Yeah, that's incredible. So when you were going back to the younger days initially, when you were kind of forced to get together and go for dinner, I imagine the telling of those life stories, as you say, was quite a big moment, and straight away all the judgments that you all would have had about each other would have, I'm assuming and kind of hoping, disappeared after you heard each other's life stories.
They really did. And it was also a trust exercise. You know that thing they call a trust fall, where you yeah. stand and close your eyes and fall backwards and people are supposed to catch you and you sure hope they do? Well, we were telling each other our most intimate secrets. Everybody did it. And I describe it as like giving each other the nuclear materials of our lives, that we could have destroyed each other with the secrets we shared. And no one did. No word of it ever left the hall, what was called, where we would meet. And so it was both the stories that we told and the act of telling them that allowed us to form these incredibly strong bonds that lasted for 40 years, and to allow us to just stop being so quick to judge one another.
That's really amazing that nobody broke that trust. I mean, just because people say you're not allowed to say anything, that doesn't mean that people won't. That's really special that nobody did. It would have been very easy for people to say, oh, you never guess what he told me, and it become gossip and people get bullied because of it. I mean, it could go horribly wrong, couldn't it?
Absolutely. And we were also beautifully instructed with the rules of listening. And this is something I think that can apply to any situation in life. Before anyone gave their life story, and by the way, these life stories were, people would talk anywhere from 3 to 7 hours about their life.
Wow.
So people told everything, but we were told to listen, not to interrupt, to ask questions that were genuine questions, that no one needed to answer any question, to be supportive, and just rules for good listening. And those have served us well, too. We talk about that a lot when we get together. And so in the book, I share some of the stories, but with everyone's permission. So I definitely asked before I put it in the book.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. It sounds like this experiment really kind of set you all up for life.
It really did. And so for an example, this is in the book, but Maxie, this big, strong, rugby-playing, wrestling jock, he was a nationally ranked athlete. In his audit, that's what we called them, talked about how his little brother had almost drowned and how devastated he was about losing his father to a brain tumor when he was a toddler, and the man who had adopted him. And he poured his heart out. And all of a sudden, this obnoxious, loud, beer guzzling, rugby playing jock became a real human being right before my eyes. And what is so meaningful to me is that I would have robbed myself of a great friendship had I never given him the chance. And had it not been for this society, I might never have done so.
Yeah. Wow. It's so, so profound, isn't it? And a huge reminder to all of you at the time, but to everybody listening, that everybody has a story and everybody is the way they are because of something, because of things that have happened to them throughout their life, maybe ways that they've been treated in the past. I think in general, we're, as human beings, we're all quick to judge people just on, dare I say it, on their looks, but also on the way, certainly on the way people behave, often without understanding or certainly knowing what their story is and their background.
Yeah, that's really exactly it. And I'm not saying in this book that we can be friends with everyone, because I actually don't think that's true. But I think we can be friends with far, far more people than we might think. And we can be friends with everyone who shares our values. And we'll discover that a lot more people share our values if we give them the chance. And part of giving them the chance is hearing their story, not interrupting, hearing what they have to say.
And I think life can be so much more enriching with these unlikely friendships. You know, life would be, well, easy, I suppose, to only hang around with people who are like you, you know, from the same kind of background, from the same area, the same kind of class system, possibly, all those kind of things. You know, a lot of people sadly do go through life and only associate with people like them because that's kind of normal, I guess. And it's only when you start building friends with people. I mean, it happens to us a lot abroad, definitely, because you're automatically becoming friends with people from different areas because you've moved away from home. So I feel very, very lucky living in a different country to what I grew up in, because that happens much more organically. But it's so, life is so much more enriching that way, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. And we still, Maxie and I have gone on that part of the tour together. He still cracks me up. We're still totally different. He is still loud and obnoxious. and he owns it. But he is a man of extraordinary values. He's a great human being. And I'm still the same nutty, neurotic person I always have been. One of our big jokes is I'm not a physically demonstrative person. I'm not a hugger. I barely like to shake hands. I like to sort of nod in someone's direction. He envelops me in these huge bear hugs every time he sees me, which I really hate. And he insists on doing it. Yes, we still enrich each other's lives. We still learn from one another. And I do think that it's so much easier just to hang out with people who are exactly like you, who share the same interests and grew up in the same background. And it's such a loss to go through your life like that. It's a joy, I find, to meet people who are in one or almost every respect totally different.
Yeah. And presumably you, from what you've learned during this experiment nearly 40 years ago, I assume you've kind of taken those lessons throughout your life, with not just with this group of people, but with other people. So if you're traveling, if you're abroad, do you kind of make a conscious effort to talk to people that you wouldn't normally talk to?
Absolutely. And I have one little life hack for that, where I've met extraordinary people, which is, because I lived abroad for so many years, I used to have to travel a lot. I was on airplanes all the time. And I was one of those people who pulled out my book, put on my headphones, and sent that do not talk to me vibe. So it was so easy to do it. I did it reflexively. And now I take off the headphones, I put down the book. I don't immediately engage the person next to me in conversation, but if they want to talk, I talk to them, and I've met wonderful people that way. And I think, again, it's just the effort of making yourself receptive to people who want to talk to you. You don't even have to approach them, and extraordinary people come into your lives who are unexpected and marvelous.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And that being on a plane is the perfect example of that. I think everybody can relate to thinking in their heads, don't talk to me. I want to read my book, or I want to watch a film, or I just want to close my eyes and listen to music or look out of the window, you know, just literally putting out the vibe of do not talk to me. And then other times, if you are in the mood for a chat, that you do, you feel different. You're kind of looking at people, trying to make eye contact, smiling, and you're a lot more receptive to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is fair to say that on an extremely long flight, you might want to wait until the last couple of hours before you send out the please talk to me vibe, just out of sheer self-preservation. But still, it is worthwhile, or it has been for me when I've sent it out at some point. And I also do try to put myself in situations where I meet people who aren't like me. One of the things that I jokingly refer to as going to things I'm not interested in. So when I'm at home in New York, I'll scan the pages of the cultural goings on, and I'll actually choose something that really doesn't interest me and just go to it.
Go and watch a Yankee game or something.
Watch a Yankee game or some of the poor lecture on numismatics. I can't even remember what numismatics are. It's coins.
I'm glad.
Right?
I have no idea either.
Let's just say it's coins and then people can correct us. But not only do you hear something that maybe does interest you, but you meet people around who are totally different. So I do try to carry these lessons on. And Maxie, the guy wrote the book about, went on to found an extraordinary school on the island of Eleuthera in the Bahamas called the Island School. And the Island School brings together kids from all over the U.S. and Bahamian kids and puts them in groups where they have to meet kids totally unlike them, and they form friendships for life. And so he's actually taken the spirit of our secret society and reproduced it in a high school in the Bahamas.
Oh, that's wonderful. Absolutely brilliant. Well, it's a great story. I've loved hearing your story. Will Schwalbe, thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's on our website, tre.radio. It's called We Should Not Be Friends, The Story of a Friendship. Will, thank you so much for joining us. Keep spreading the joy.
I will. Thank you so much for having me on. Take care.